the subobject classifier and tried to explain a bit how this subobject classifier worked. Now what I'll try to do is to redefine it a bit better in this topos here. For just an arbitrary category. And the reason is because this will be the topos that we will use to define quantum theory for a particular choice of this category. Now, for a start, we're just going to leave it arbitrary, and we'll define the truth object and the truth arrow. Now, a lot of time, this guy, you can either call it truth object or subobject classifier, although subobject classifier technically is these two together. But sometimes you can just call this subobject classifier. And you use it interchangeably, or truth object. It's kind of used interchangeably. So we're going to analyze a bit more detail what these things are in this topos here. So before, since the subobject classifier identifies subobjects, we need to define the concept of a subobject in this topos. So since this is a topos of presheaves, or contravariant functors, if you have a presheaf, then a subobject will be still a presheaf. Such that, now we've seen that the general definition requires certain monic arrows between the two objects. So how does that translate in this topos here? It translates as follows. So this is a subobject of X, well, if or such that. There is a natural transformation between the two. Where for each element in your category, the individual components are the desired monic arrows. So this is in terms of presheaves. Once you pick an element, this arrow here is in sets, so is an inclusion. So this is the level of object. However, a presheaf has internal structure. So how does this map act at the level of functions? So if you have a map, then you require that the image of the map given by this functor somehow is related to the image of the same map given by that functor. So what this means is that you require that the following diagram commutes. What is the injector? So it's contravariant, so they go the other way around, yeah? So what this means, the fact that this diagram commutes, means that this map here is simply the same as this, only that now it's restricted to only be defined on the sub-codomain. So what this means is that this guy here is simply this guy restricted to this. And if you have that, you get a well-defined sub-presheaf. You can also draw like this. So this is your X of A. It goes from A to B. This is what I call it Y. So that this maps. I'll get simply restricted to not act on this guy. And this is the definition of a sub-presheaf. So it's still a presheaf such that at the level of sets, the subsets, and the maps are just defined in terms of restriction.
in that diagram, should it be x of b to the lower right or y of b there as well?
Oops. Yep. Thank you. Okay, so this is a sub-object. Now, we want to define this thing here. So what is a terminal object in this topos? So it's, again, it's a pre-sheaf. Everything that's there is a pre-sheaf. Remember, the abstract definition was that there's only one arrow from any object to the terminal object. But what is that in the topos of pre-sheaf? Well, it's a pre-sheaf. So it's a map from your category to sets, such that for each element, it assigns something here. And what it assigns is the terminal object in sets. So it assigns this guy. And for each arrow, it assigns an arrow here. Being a pre-sheaf, it goes the other way around. And this is simply the identity map. Since each object gets assigned a singleton, the only possible maps are the identity maps. So a terminal object is on that. It's like a collection of set terminal objects. Okay, given this, now what we need to define is this sub-object classifier or truth object. I think I already said it, but I'll just rewrite the definition. Actually, I'm going to write down here. So what is this object here? So it's a pre-sheaf. So also this guy is a map from your category to sets. And what it does, as we see that, so the last time, to each object, it assigns the set of sieves on that object, which you denote like this, set of sieves on A. So all possible sieves on A. And to each map, you go the other way around. Take a sieve, and you basically define in terms of the pullback. So this is all those arrows with codomain B, such that when composed, they belong to it. So again, pictorially, you get this guy. So this is a C. Okay, so now what we need to define is the truth arrow in this context. So what is the true arrow? So this true arrow is now a natural transformation, right? You have this functor, this pre-sheaf, and this pre-sheaf. So being a natural transformation, it has components. From the components of that given from the terminal object to the set obtained with truth object. And this we've seen is just the singleton. So it maps the singleton to some element here. which is identified with the principal sieve on A. So how you do this, so this is your terminal object. And what you do, you go here, pick your element D, you get a singleton, then the singleton is mapped to the principal sieve on D. And that's the only map you can have. And then you go here, and you map it to the principal sieve on C. Now this mapping, and so on and so forth, right? Where does the arrow go? C to D. So this mapping has to preserve the kind of internal structure of your presheaf, meaning that the element that you pick with this map and the element that you pick with this map have to be related by this arrow here for it to make sense. So what this means is that the following has to hold. Let's call it F. The requirement. If you apply the definition, then this is kind of, you can figure it out. So this is the pullback of this guy. Now F is a map with codomain D, so it will belong to a sieve on D, and it will definitely belong to the bigger sieve of D. So we've seen last lecture that the pullback of a sieve with the element of that sieve gives a principal sieve on the domain of the arrow used to pull it back. Now this, and you do this for all elements. So this is one example of, then we'll look at the general one, but this is one example of what an element is in this topos. It's basically a global section, because for each element, you pick one here, you do that for all, and it has to be such that if there is a map between the respective category, the picking is consistent. So this arrow here is a particular element, is a particular global section, the global section which picks out the maximum sieve or the maximum truth values. Now there will be many other elements, as we'll see, which pick out other truth values, but this is a particular one. Okay, now that we see how this works, how does this subobject classifier work in the topos of presheaves? So we've seen from the general definition that the subobject classifier was this object omega, that one, together with an arrow true, such that if you had a subpresheaf, this guy here was a pullback. Definition. What doesn't really mean in practice. So being presheaf land, you have to define everything context-wise. So for each element of your category, you have this. So now this thing, as soon as you apply to an element, you automatically insets. this. And you require this to be a pullback, so you're required to commute, which means that you pick an element here, you go this way, is the same as going that way. This has to be equal to true factorial. Well, sorry, it's not factorial. Okay, now this guy picks the only element that it can pick, so it gives you the singleton. This true guy gives you the principal sieve, so this is on A. This guy gives you the following. Now here we're in sets, so this inclusion really just picks the same element. So you get this thing here, which is a sieve, and is the principal sieve, which is the analog of true. So in a way, what this diagram tells is that you identify a subobject by telling you, by saying what elements belong to it, such that if an element does belong to it, then you get the analog of true. Now, to understand this a bit better, we should analyze this arrow. This arrow is the unique arrow that makes this diagram commute. But exactly what is this arrow? How do you define it? Why does this tell you anything about the subobject here? So to understand that, we analyze that arrow a little bit better. So, okay, this diagram commutes, but now for now, we're just going to forget about this. We're just going to analyze this arrow and see exactly how the fact that this gives you a sieve somehow defines your subobject. Because it seems a little bit obscure right now. So you have, did I use Y or F? If I keep changing the Y. So we have this guy. What did you say? I have this map here. We pick an element X. Let's just get X here. And this gives you a sieve. I'm not saying yet what sieve it is, but it gives you some element of here, of this object, so we know it's a sieve. Now the question is, what property, I say, does a map need to have to belong to this sieve? What kind of arrows belong to you, and what do this arrow tell you of the fact this is a subobject? Now the property that this arrow have to have is the following, that given that arrow, they have to be such that this diagram commutes. So what this is telling you that for a function, or map, sorry, for a map to belong to this sieve, it has to respect the subset relation. So maybe it's easier if you look at the picture. So these are these guys. This is
is f of b.
So what that tells you that you have a function, a sieve, that function has to be such that it does actually map subsets to subsets. So it can't be a map that goes like this, then here, then somewhere else. That will not tell you anything about the subobject. So what it does have to do, it really has to map this subset to this other one, and so on. So it really preserves a kind of subobject. So in other words, this set here has to be formed of all those maps such that this is true. So all those maps, which when brought at the level of the presheaf, respect the definition of a subobject. So in that sense, you know something about the subobject given that sieve because of this. Okay, now this is how you define it to show that there is a relation between this element here and the subobject. However, now given this definition, we need to show that this is actually a sieve. And this definition tells you that whatever you pick here actually has got some relation with this subobject because it preserves this relation. Now you have to show that it's actually a sieve. So you have to prove that. I'm going to go here. So you have to show that this guy, right the wrong way around, I suppose it doesn't matter, is a sieve. How do you show this? You construct this diagram. You just, every time you prove something, you just make diagrams. Actually, let's do it the other way around. By the property of this guy being a subobject, this diagram commutes. So this is good. Now you assume that F actually belongs to a sieve on A. By this property, then you know that X of F belongs to this guy here. However, the fact that this guy commutes, also tells you that if you go this way, you end up here, right? So it tells you this. Which is the same as this. But this condition is simply this, because this tells you that all the maps, such that when lifted at the level of presheaf, the element belongs to the image of the domain of that arrow, which is exactly this. This arrow here goes from C to A. So what this condition is telling you is that also this arrow belongs to this. Also this belongs here. If you remember the definition of a sieve, it's a closed out on the left composition, meaning that if an element belongs to a sieve, then the composition also belongs to a sieve. So you have shown that this guy is actually a sieve.
Is it clear?
Do we want right composition? Or is that what we have anyway?
I'm not sure. I might have to wait. So F is
yeah,
from...
Yeah, I think we want to apply G first.
Oops. G goes from, yeah, right, you're right. Thank you. I was getting it. But it is clear what that is the same condition. So what this is, all this is telling you is the following. It's called the omega axiom, yeah. So, first, okay, what all this amounts to is that F belongs to this guy here, to a sieve, if and only if X of F belongs to F. You can go both ways. And this then implies this omega axiom. Which states the following. So this guy is a sub-object classifier. Implying also that you have the respective true arrow. If and only if there exists a 1-to-1. So 1-to-1 is injective. Correspondence. Sub-objects of X and the characteristic functions kind of, so the maps from X to omega. So this is another way of defining what this truth object or sub-object classifier is. Now we've seen going that way that you had a sub-object. You could identify it through this element here in terms of this formulation. We've seen that it was a sieve. Now, what if you go the other way around? So what if you have a characteristic function? How do you now define a sub-object? Well, as we did in sets, we kind of define in terms of pullback. So for each element, we define this. This is cat, yeah. And this defines a sub-object. So the important thing really is that there is an isomorphism, which this is the formulation of this wordy thing, is as follows. so maps between whatever, well, whatever category you are in, between that and your sub-object. And this is another way of defining your sub-object classifier. Okay. Now what I want to do now is, so I define the arrow true somewhere, but I don't think I deleted it, in terms of an element of this sub-object classifier omega. However, it's a very special element because it would just pick the maximum sieve. But there are many more elements which actually are defined in a particular way. And these are the following. So an element in whatever topos you are or category is always a map. Well, now we're just going to use this just to use it, but it's just a map from your terminal object to whatever object you're defining an element of. And in particular, it's a global element. Now, the reason you distinguish, you actually call it global element, because in a topos, you also have something called a local element, which in sets you don't have. I mean, sets either is an element or it's not. But in a topos, you have something that's really an element, a global element, and you have something that's called a local element or local section, which it is an element in certain contexts. It's not defined globally. So what's a global element? Well, again, it's a map from your terminal object to whatever object, such that all elements. So we're still here, yes? So there's a natural transformation such that for each element, the individual components, again, pick, oops, an element here. This is a singleton, and this is some sieve. Now, the arrow true was a special one, yeah? But this is a general one. And again, this global element has to be such that if you have a map then okay, that goes from B to A, rather K of B of this guy is equal to K of A. Which we saw for the arrow true how it worked, but this is true for any global element and any pre-sheaf. So there has to be a kind of consistency condition. And I'm not sure if I deleted the picture. Okay, I keep deleting what I need. So that guy is a global element, a global section. Now, the reason they're important, these global sections, is because the collection of these global sections of the sub-object classifier of this guy here are the actual truth values. Locally, you have sieves, but that's only locally. An element is composed of a lot of local elements. So an element of your truth object is actually a global section. And are these global sections that will represent truth values, which when computed context-wise give you the the sieve definition. But your truth bar is a collection of these sieves, such that this consistency condition is preserved. So, this collection of global sections of your truth object or global elements, and each of these elements represents a truth value, and the collection of all this guy forms a Hating algebra. So here we've got a two-level structure, right? For each context, you have this collection of all, the collection of all sieves. That is a Hating algebra for each of them. However, the collection of all local, global sections, which pick a particular sieve, such that this consistency condition is preserved, also that all of these guys forms a Hating algebra. And the way to see it is that each of these elements, being a map like this, you have to define it context-wise, and each context-wise, then you just go here, and you get this Hating algebra here. But the elements are global sections. And so here is where you get this multivariate logic. As you can see, I mean, you have the one that picks the principal sieve. So the arrow true, right, would pick over the principal sieve. So that would be the highest element in this logic. Then you would have the one that picks the zero element. And it will continue picking the zero element because of this consistency condition. And that would be like the analog of false. But you have a lot of stuff in between. So you get a multivariate logic. Now, how these truth values really work, we will see when we give the concrete examples in quantum theory. But you have to remember, these guys here are the truth values. They're local, global sections. Global. Okay, now I'm actually going to also describe what a local section is, because it will turn out to be quite important, not for truth values, but for stating certain theorems for quantum theory in the context of the topos. So what are these local sections or local elements? Local sections. Okay, to define a local section, you first need to define a sub-presheaf of the terminal object. So you sub-presheaf of your terminal object. The presheaves, so you will go from your category to sets, such that for each element, this guy will pick here a set, which will be a subset of whatever set is picked by a terminal object. Now this guy is just the singleton. So you don't really have much choice here. You can either pick the singleton or just the empty thing. That's all you can do. Okay, so fast for objects is fine. What about maps? So you have a map here. And you want to map it here. U of F. No, sorry. U of A to U of B. I've deleted the definition, but this map has to be defined in terms of the restriction of the map that you would obtain from the terminal object. Restricted to U of A. And we've seen that the terminal object, having all singletons, only has identity maps. There's only maps that you have. So now you have two situations again. You have a singleton, then you're fine, because this map actually exists. Fine. Now if you have this, then you're kind of in trouble, because you can't really map it. Well, you can map it to that, but you can't map it to this guy. So what this means is that these maps kind of well-defined on a certain domain of your category, only that domain which gives you the singleton. In the other cases, they're not really defined. This is why these guys are called local sections, because when you actually go and define the sections, then you have this. So a local section now becomes a map from the sub-object to, we'll just keep using this guy, such that for any element, the individual component is this. Which now is defined all in those cases where you get this element here. Some sieve. In other cases, you can't define it. Now, in the case that you can define, you still have the same requirements. So you still require that. That this holds, like the global sections. So this goes from A to B, omega A to omega B. So for the thing, for the kind of domain for which these local sections are defined, then the same requirement as the global section holds, but only for a certain domain. When you get the zero, then you don't have this local sections anymore. So here you'd have like a cut. So at some point you can define it, these local sections, and then let's say here you get the zero one, and here is all defined well, and then there's a zero, and you stop. You got a collection of local sections, but you just can't extend it to the entire tree sheaf. You have kind of packets, pockets of your local sections. Now, the reason they're important, this local section, is that generally most presheaves have local sections. And the fact that they have local section by no means means that they have global sections. In fact, a lot of presheaves have local sections, but they do not have global sections. And the reason it's important is because when we'll define quantum theory in terms of topos theory, since we're going to use this topos here for a particular choice, so that the state space will be a presheaf, be something like that. And it turns out that you can express the Cauchy-Specker theorem that we did at the very start as a mathematical statement that your state space doesn't have global sections. It will have local ones, but it will not have global sections. And there's the topos equivalent of the Cauchy-Specker theorem, which we'll do. So that's why the difference between local and global is important. Okay. Oh. What is it? Right, now, so as far as topos constructions, I'm going to stop now. And I'll try and motivate. Well, I won't be able to start defining topos theory, not quantum theory in terms of a topos, but at least I'm going to try and physically motivate why we use this guy. Okay. Right, now this category here, I think, well, no, I'm not going to be able to do this really. But next lecture, I think I'll do it, will be the category of abelian von Neumann subalgebras. What they are, we'll see next lecture. However, the reason why you chose this topos can also be seen by using a much more simpler category. So basically, you first consider your Hilbert space, and you consider the algebra of bounded operators on your Hilbert space. It's non-commuting, fine. Now what you do is you construct a category. Now, this is an abuse of notation because this is actually how you define abelian von Neumann algebras, but it doesn't matter. So you construct a category, and this is a category. And it has its elements, abelian subalgebras of this algebra here. So it's operators such that they commute. And it has as maps, simple inclusion. So you can define a kind of similar to what we'll do for real, but you can define this topos. So the topos of Presheaves, and the base category is the collection of these commuting algebras. So when you go and define your elements, you obtain, okay, I like drawing pictures. You obtain this thing here. Whatever those elements might be. But an element in this Presheaf would be something like that, right? Now, the reason why we chose this category, or anyway, even if you consider von Neumann, you'll still consider abelian subalgebras. And the reason is that in the maybe first and second lecture, I tried and explained certain kind of conceptual problems in quantum theory. And most of them, or at least the quantum weirdness, comes from the fact that a lot of operators don't commute. So what you do is you say, okay, let's consider kind of local classical approximation, classical in the sense that now you have everything that commutes. You consider all of them. And then you define the quantum object as a collection of local classical approximations. So like classical snapshots. Now it seems a bit cheating, but because the collection of all these local classical snapshots forms a category, you can always map information. So in a way, this mapping of information kind of puts back the quantum picture back, since the actual object is all of it. But now you define your collection, your big object, in terms of local classical snapshots. So when we will define the state space, this guy here, for a particular commuting algebra, can be seen as a classical state space, and so on and so forth. However, the quantum state space is all of them. So it is in this sense that you kind of try and put back in the picture some realism. Because now the realism is local. However, the quantum object is global. But because each of your objects will be defined as a collection of classical approximations, it turns out that you can retain some classicality. So that's the kind of trick. You don't retain all of the classicality because then you get these truth values. So you get a multivalued logic, but you still get a logic which enables you to define truth values for anything that you can think of. And the reason is this context dependent, but it's not context dependent like don't know, maybe I think it was Bohm that did it. But not context dependent, that you define your elements according to what else commutes. Context dependent because you define your thing contextually, but then you consider all of them. It's a little bit different. It's this considering all of them that is the difference. So that is the, well, the idea, not really trick, the idea. So I don't think it's fine. So next time we'll see what a von Neumann algebra is. I mean, von Neumann algebras, they really relate. There's a kind of one-to-one correspondence. They're really related to these guys, but they're not really that much different. So this reasoning is precisely the same. Is the idea of this classical idea of what we're going to do clear? Collection of local classical snapshots. But we'll see that in more details tomorrow. Right, I forgot the exercise sheets at home. Sorry, not the exercise sheet, the solutions. But not those, the ones that you gave me.
Oh.
Yeah, those I remember. But you all did very well.